But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell. I'm here with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. Here we are, the Sunday after Christmas.
Yeah, we're on our way to the Happy New Year thing, right? Yeah, 2026. Who'd have thought? Crazy. You know, I was just saying to our friend Patrick that, you know, days go so slow, and the years just spin by at an incredible rate. You know,
it's
just
it does.
It's nuts. But it is what it is, and so somewhere in the show, we're going to have to talk about little sparkly wines, I think, you know, because New Year's Eve is the time for celebration and, you know, and renewed interest in all that you're doing and, you know,
so I have
for a new year.
I have a couple of questions relative to that. Well, first of all, I don't want to name the restaurant, but I went to a restaurant that had a raw bar the other day. And they had cocktail sauce. They had horseradish. And the raw bar contained oysters, clams, lobster, shrimp, and king crab legs. So my question is, I think I know the answer, but so you talk about putting cocktail sauce on clams and oysters or whatever, sort of overtakes the taste.
I think so,
So I do know also that when you use mignonette, you're not exactly thrilled with that either, because it, I guess, dulls your sensory taste buds and you don't enjoy your wine.
Yeah, well, classic mignonette is made with pepper, shallots, and red wine vinegar. And there's nothing that destroys, you know, wine more than vinegar. I mean, it's a terrible combo. So I don't do that. I make my quote unquote mignonette another way. I use verjus, which is unfermented wine, basically juice from unfermented wine.
But would it be unusual not to serve mignonette?
I think you know. Listen, I've been to a lot of raw bars, and you know, people are doing different things. There's a place called Eventide up in Massachusetts and in Maine. And they do different sorbets, believe it or not, on their oysters.
Sorbet?
They make sorbet out of wasabi. They'll do a horseradish sorbet. They'll do a wasabi sorbet, and they'll serve a little of that.
So people
are doing different things.
Call me overcritical.
You're overcritical.
But when I went for the oyster, I went for the clam, sandy. Now, I know it's a casualty of the enjoyment.
Environment.
But
I think it's more shelly than sandy. It was really sandy on a raw clam, on a raw oyster, man. It's probably little pieces of shell, because they don't really grow them in sand. I guess the clams, they dig them in sand. But, you know, I don't know. I've never come across that.
And then they served like a poached whitefish. There were two of them on this like huge. It was like a 48-inch platter. What do they do after the event when there's leftovers on something like that?
A couple of things. You know, you can repurpose that into a soup. You can repurpose it into kind of a dip. You could smoke that fish and make a smoked fish dip. You know, you put that on the table as an appetizer with, you know, some toasted bread or whatever. You can give it to the help, you know, because we're obligated to feed the help twice a day. You know, so there's things that you do. It never, I don't say never, but for me, it never goes in the garbage. I always find something to do with it. And I think that's the part of, you know, the learning curve of being a chef is how to, you know, how to utilize stuff that comes back. Obviously in a healthy way, you know.
My next critique is if there's Eggs Benedict. Should the English muffin be crisp?
Well, it depends. Yeah, I mean, if you're opening, you know, if you open a restaurant, like, say, at 11:30, and you have it on a buffet, and it's not getting used, it sits in a chafing dish, it's not going to be crisp. It's that food doesn't travel well, you know, thing.
Well, I actually wouldn't want it to be crisp. I thought it should be, you know, lightly toasted, you know, soft.
Yeah, I guess it's a preference thing. I'm not a big fan of the genre. I don't really love Eggs Benedict. I think Hollandaise sauce is one of those volatile things where, you know, if it's not refreshed every, you know, half hour or so, you know, you can have a problem with it. I use what I call comeback sauce on Eggs Benedict. So they're not, excuse me, it wouldn't be a traditional Benedict, but it's along the same lines. You know, I'll use a crab cake under it, or lobster or smoked salmon rather than the ham. I don't really like the ham thing. But then we'll put comeback sauce on it, which is, I make comeback sauce with smoked tomatoes and mustard mayonnaise.
This is very technical. So when you're eating a lobster, the red is the roe.
Mm-hmm.
What is the green gook?
The green gook is the roe that didn't get cooked enough.
Really?
No, I'm just... No, it's the insides. It's the offal.
But you're supposed to enjoy that.
Yeah, some people like it. Some people push it aside. You know, I knew somebody who loved it. You know, she would ask for extra. You know, for me or whatever if I had it. I don't care one way or the other. You can have it. You know, but yeah, it's all part of the experience, I think. And the red part's the roe. That's the eggs. You know, they just get that bright red color. And it's you know, when you think about the process, it's just cooking unborn lobsters, you know, kind of thing.
And one last question. So again, the Robo had a lobster.
Mm-hmm.
Do you eat cold lobster with?
Generally, it depends on how cracked it is. I mean, you mean as far as an accompaniment?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like butter. I like warm butter.
I realize in retrospect they had melted butter,
mm-hmm.
and I probably should have drizzled some on the lobster.
Yeah. Lobster, you know, lobster, shrimp, they don't really have a very distinctive flavor. I mean, it's kind of nuanced, you know. And I think hence that's why, you know, with shrimp, everybody's looking for cocktail sauce or horseradish or something, you know, kind of helps the thing along.
So that's funny you say that. So one of the guests was saying, you know, if they're serving really nice shrimp, I'll take that over lobster. And I said, that's kind of interesting because both lobster and shrimp naked don't have much taste.
They don't. And that's the key. You know, that's one of the reasons why I say I never broil them. You know, or bake them. I generally, you know, just steam them lightly, you know, and as lightly as I can without leaving some raw in there. And I even have a thing, excuse me, on my menu out in Allure, is that I don't come in and asking me for, you know, baked stuffed or grilled or whatever. I won't do it, you know. I'm not going to defile this magnificent creature with a whole bunch of flame. So I basically want it to be as pure. If you're going to die for the cause, dude, I want to represent you as best I can, you know. It's a conscience thing. So, you know, we only steam them out there, and for good reason. I think they eat better that way. They're much, much more tender, and the flavor is better. You know, it's not like beat up with the fire.
I wish our audience could be here in the studio with us because somebody was just dancing on the roof.
I know. It was a fiddler. I think it was a fiddler.
So, I like the fact that you said you would sort of give us your take on wine or champagne for New Year's Eve. I don't have the bottle in front of me, but I know I read this correctly.
You don't have a frontal lobotomy either.
What?
You don't have the bottle in front of you, and you don't have a frontal lobotomy.
Well said. So there was a bottle of Pindar sparkling wine.
Right.
And it says North Fork Champagne.
Yeah.
Are they allowed? I mean, Champagne is a region of France.
Yeah. It's I wouldn't have done that personally. But, you know, Pindar is Pindar and they do what they want to do. Yeah. I think it's, yeah. One of the funniest comments I've ever heard in the wine world. There was a woman walked into Pominac when I was there and said, how come you people don't make Chianti out here? Chianti's a region in Italy. It's kind of hard to do a region here. It's the same thing with Champagne. Champagne is a region, and by law, you're not allowed to call anything Champagne that's not from Champagne. The caveat there is probably the North Fork part, you know, and they're saying, you know, it's they want people to realize that it's like a Champagne, I guess. And it is to some degree. I mean, the fact that it's a sparkling wine, probably made out of, my guess is Chardonnay and Pinot Meunier, because they grow a lot of Pinot Meunier, Pindar. And that's one of the three grapes that they use in Champagne. So I'm sure that's what their intention was. The execution, I'm not a fan of. I think it does the North Fork a disservice a little bit. Like, you have to, you know, qualify that to sell it. You know, I mean, North Fork sparkling wine is good on its own. You don't need the Champagne reference.
So I have a couple of more things to ask you. So it's interesting. This past couple of weeks, I've been offered homemade chicken soup by a few people, and one of them I had over the weekend, and I erred in when I thanked her for, you know, sharing her chicken, her chicken soup, matzo ball soup with me. I said, I've not had somebody put potatoes in it. She goes, Stu, those were not potatoes. Those were turnips. Now, can turnips taste like potatoes?
Yeah, well, they're kind of mild, you know, like potatoes. Turnips need some help. All root vegetables, except for maybe carrots. Carrots have a more distinctive flavor, and parsnips too, to some degree. But they need a little. To me, I do a lot of parsnips. What I'll do is I'll steam them until they're pretty soft, and then I'll whip them with butter and a little salt and pepper. Sometimes in the off season, you get the parsnips. They don't have that sweetness that they normally have in the fall. And I'll add a little bit of sugar. But for the most part, they're on their own. They're good. My grandmother used to do the same thing with turnips. Now, there's a couple different kinds. You have those little Hokkaido turnips, the Japanese ones, the small ones. And they're kind of, they almost have a bitter edge to them. They need a little help. They need a little sugar when you saute them. But she used to get the big yellow ones, and then she would mash them up like mashed potatoes with a little bit of sugar and butter. And they were fabulous. I loved them. And you know, the what's it called? The modern snack bar?
Yeah.
Out in Aquabog, they sell like 2,000 or 3,000 pounds of turnips every season. You know, it's amazing. And I don't think people, they don't really, I don't use them. It's not for any other reason other than I don't think about it, because there's no big call. Oh, God, how come you don't have turnips on your menu? But I think that, you know, if you take, were they the yellow ones or the white ones?
It had a white tinge to it.
Yeah. So it were probably the smaller ones. But, yeah, I think it's one of those vegetables that's
It was tasty,
overlooked.
So I, very you know, good, man. That's all that matters. But
yeah.
So here's another one for you. So there used to be two Frank's steakhouses, one in Jericho and one in Rockville Center. And
it was
Terry's
one,
daughter.
There was another one east of that, too, on Sunrise.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, it was like Wantagh, briefly, yeah.
So right now there's none. The one at Rockville Center was the last one standing, and the landlord decided he wants to repurpose the building, so it's gone. But Kerry's daughter, Marcy, loved the skirt steak there. Mm-hmm. And so we went to this other steak restaurant, and she was disappointed.
Was it the same?
And she said, you know... How do I explain this? She said, it's like sweet and it's crispy. And it was a similar discussion to what you were saying about your grandma's pork loin the other day. The fat gets sort of crispy. You called it candy.
Candy, yeah.
I guess they must have marinated their skirt steak in like a teriyaki sauce, and somehow crispen up.
The sugar. Yeah, because, you know, skirt steak, I mean, there's some fat in it, but doesn't have fat, like a fat cap like a pork loin would have, you know, to get that candy-like thing. If you want, I'll sneak you in a really good steak marinade recipe. If we give, you know, our listeners a chance to go get a pen and a piece of paper, we could hum the Jeopardy.
Also, if you don't have a pen and paper at hand, if you send an email to us at fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com, we will be glad to mail you a recipe card or send you an email with the recipe.
Yeah, the recipe is really easy. It's actually four equal parts of a blended olive oil, not extra virgin, a blended olive oil, Worcestershire sauce, soy sauce, and rice wine, lemon juice. You use rice wine vinegar too, but use lemon juice. So it's lemon juice, soy sauce, Worcestershire, and an 80-20 blend of olive oil. You can use a quart of each, you can use a cup of each, you can use a teaspoon of each, it doesn't matter, just as long as they're equal parts. And then I augment that with a little bit of garlic powder, enough to your taste, some fresh basil, and I use sriracha in there also, again, to taste. And then this, for a quart of each, I would use a pound of brown sugar. So if you were going to use a cup, you know, you'd have to divide that by four, use a quarter of a pound of brown sugar. A cup of each will give you two cups, will give you four cups, like a quart of marinade, which is good. So I would use a quarter pound of brown sugar. And just stir it up and, you know, marinate that. You got to be careful. You can marinate it overnight, but if you leave it in too long, the soy sauce and salt in the soy sauce draws the moisture out of the steak, and you'll have a hard time keeping it rare, and it'll get, like, brown on the inside. It's not bad. It just takes some of the moisture out of there and allows the steak to dry out a little bit. But if you do, you know, 12 hours or even overnight, you're fine, you know. But it's a great marinade for skirt steak, especially if you're going to do it on the grill, because that sugar, like Stu was saying before, that sugar browns up and crisps and gives you a little bit of a char on the outside, which is always nice, especially if you're going to leave a little rare on the inside. It's a great combination. So that's my my marinade chef tip number 3742.
And my last question is, took out a broiled seafood platter from a restaurant, and tasteless.
I haven't seen a broiled seafood platter since probably 1969, 70. I mean, that's just such an anachronistic, you know, was it a couple of scallops, the shrimp, and a flounder or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a standard practice way back in the steakhouses and stuff.
I don't know. Tasteless. The only thing that was salvageable was that the flounder was sort of crispy on the edges, which was good. But now, if I heat that up, what can I do to give it some pizzazz? Now, just to make it worse, it came with a side of rice that had no taste.
I think you should just have a funeral for it. You know, bite the bullet, you know, throw it out and start over. You know, this, you know, yeah, what are you going to rescue with? Lemon and butter or something? You know, I don't know, wishbone Italian? Something. It's like, you know, when you get a bad one, somebody once said to me, if you had 15 pounds of gold and 1 pound of doo-doo, you have 16 pounds of doo-doo. You know what I mean? So it's the same thing with that. I would just throw it out and find something else. And just lesson learned, you know. There's things you just don't eat anymore. That's, you know, you would have to, I don't know, you would have to salt it. You'd have to lemon it. You'd have to butter it, you know, if you're not going to have a sauce with it or something. It's just, to me, it's a silly item.
You're going to laugh at me. I started dipping it in cocktail sauce.
Well, yeah, of course. You're trying.
But it was terrible.
And you want to rescue it. It was terrible. Here, tell you, don't you love people go, boy, this stinks to high heaven. Here, smell this. No, I trust you.
No, that I always love that at a restaurant when somebody goes, oh, this tastes
awful.
Like
yeah,
this tastes like dog poo.
Yeah,
try it.
Yeah, no thanks. I have all the faith in your taste buds. Oh, God.
So I guess I lied because I have another question. At the buffet, they had deviled eggs.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked what goes into a deviled egg, and I said it's the egg yolk, beaten or whipped, maybe some mustard.
A little bit of mustard, mayonnaise also.
Do some people put onion into it or something? Or?
I don't know. I would never do that, but, you know, cayenne pepper, you know, sometimes the devil part of sriracha, Tabasco. You know, anything to make it devilish. The thing to me about deviled eggs, they're kind of cool. You know, I kind of like them, but I need a topping, you know.
Oh, it's nice to have some caviar on top.
Yeah, caviar or bacon or shrimp or, you know, small, very small shrimp on there, chives, you know, something to give
wait,
it a little.
Wait. Ho.
Santa Claus is coming to town.
Shrimp has no taste. You're putting a baby shrimp on there?
Yeah. No, shrimp has a taste. It just doesn't have a lot of taste, you know.
But sometimes shrimp has more of a texture than a taste.
Yeah, it's like a little crunch, you know. But I think it's fun just from the visual, you know, standpoint. You know, it gives color, you know, it gives a, you know, a reason to go over there. And I think that, you know, I mean, there are people that have really done some interesting things with deviled eggs. You know, smoked salmon on there. They, you know, like I said, shrimp on there. There's, you know, like cured bacon I've seen on there. So it's a fun thing to play around with. I think they're a kind of a fun appetizer, actually. They made a comeback, I guess, about maybe 10 years ago. You know, I hadn't seen deviled eggs in the restaurant game forever, you know. And then about 10 years ago, they started appearing on menus. And I think some of it has to do with, you know, guys trying to, you know, chefs trying to find a way to make a little money without a big layout. You know, eggs were fairly inexpensive.
So another one. What is the difference between a blintzer and a crepe?
Well, a blintz is smaller, you know, and thicker, and a crepe is very thin. I don't know what the doughs are probably a little different. I'd have to really look and check because I haven't made a blintz in a long time. But they usually make them a little bit thicker, you know, especially if you're going to hold caviar on and sour cream or something. It can't be thin like a crepe. It would just break apart, you know. But, yeah, that's another thing you don't see too much anymore, blintzes and crepes. Yeah, I guess there's a couple of creperies out there, you know, a couple of people that do it as a restaurant, but not many. Even you know, that there's certain restaurants that you don't see anymore. Remember, what's that place with all the fondues? A Melting Pot, right? Right down on 110 in Farmingdale. I remember going in there with Malibu Sue one time. You know, we stopped there to get a glass of wine, and I guess we had a fondue of sorts. And it was kind of fun, you know. I mean, it was, but that was like a 60s thing, you know, when all the rage was these house parties with fondue pots, you know. You don't see that anywhere anymore. I think Melting Pot's the only one I've ever heard of. And I think they're a chain. I think they have a couple of them.
Yeah.
Around the world.
I find that it is an interesting restaurant. You get tired quickly because it's not like you're getting the a steak, and then you're
an
doing
appetite.
The
yeah. You'd have to order three or four pots of that.
But the thing is, it's all
fondue.
It's all fondue. That's what I'm going. It's not like you get a burger and then you get fondue course,
yeah,
or whatever.
More like fondant.
And it's interesting that because when you talk about, you know, cooking in a pot, the big things are the Korean soup places.
Oh my God, those are so good.
Oh yeah,
but hot. And I don't mean spicy hot. I mean it comes to the table bubbling, you know.
My only problem is you have to watch what you're ordering to put in it. Unless I'm reading it wrong, I know on one of the places I went to, there was like four types of tripe. I'm not a tripe guy. But, you know, if you get a beef, if you get a regular, you know. And the way it comes is interesting. It's usually the meat comes rolled up. And they serve it, you know, a plate of it,
uh-huh.
And then you cook it.
Yeah.
And you order vegetables and you uh-huh. cook it. I guess you get a different broth. You can get, you know, like the way I remember it, there was like a spicy tomato broth.
It's kind of a kick, like a variation of ramen, you know.
But you can get just a regular chicken soup or whatever. It's that I found very, very enjoyable.
I used to go to Flushing a lot, you know, for that. And it was a place up on Northern Boulevard. It was really in Bayside. It wasn't quite the Flushing. I can't remember the name of it. And if I could, I probably couldn't pronounce it. But it was this little mom-and-pop thing. And they served these, like, cauldrons of soup, you know. And they were thick. And you know, the thick pot holds the – it was metal. It would hold the heat. And I'm telling you, the thing would come to the table, I mean, rolling boil, you know. I mean, with the droplets coming off the top of it, you know. You'd have to wait about 20 minutes to even stick a spoon in there. You know, put the spoon in there, the handle would get hot. You know, it's crazy. But, man, it was good, you know. It was just – and I remember the one thing – the one mistake I made. I found this article in the New York Times of the 10 best Korean restaurants in Flushing. So, of course, I got to go to all 10, right? I mean, who wouldn't? And I got to number five, and I said, you know, Molly's just drinking seltzer or something. It was nighttime. I used to go for lunch, you know, nighttime. I'm going to get a glass of wine. Have you had Korean wine? No, I haven't had. Me either. Okay, let's try it. You know, don't do it. Do not drink Korean wine. It tastes like 7-Up with alcohol in it. It's like a 7-and-7 or something, you know. It was terrible, terrible. But the food, I mean, is, you know, Korean restaurants. There's a place in the city they used to call Jungsik. Have you ever been there? Jungsik. It's down in Tribeca, at the corner of Harrison and, what's the other one? It begins with an H down there. Harrison and whatever. Anyway, J-U-N-G-S-I-K. If you ever want to see where Korean food can end up in the hands of a very talented guy, that's the place. I mean, it's like the French Laundry in Korean. It's phenomenal, phenomenal. The food is, I mean, and bring your checkbook. It's going to cost you dearly, you know. But, man, it's worth every penny. What a place. I mean, the food is just stupid good, you know. It's one of the top five restaurants I've ever been in my life, you know, which is saying something because I've been in thousands. And thousands of good ones. But this one is special. It's really good. He's got a, I think either him or his chef had a spinoff, and they have a place in the 30s, which is like Korean town. And it's Atomics, A-T-O-M-I-X. Another one that's really, really good. They're expensive. They're high-end restaurants for sure. But the value's there as far as I'm concerned. I've never had finer food anywhere, you know, regardless of genre. Real good. Anyway, that's a recommendation you should. You know, it's the holidays, so shoot the lock off the safety deposit box and grab some of that cash and go down here and have yourself a ball.
There you go. So you hinted that New Year's Eve is around the corner.
Yes.
And, you know, if you were putting together a party, not at the club, but, you know, in somebody's living room, how would you orchestrate the evening?
If I was doing a house party, how would I orchestrate the evening? I'd get everybody to come in the front door and then tell them all we're going out and take them to dinner. It's easier. I don't know. I think for me, I don't think it should be a dinner thing. To me, New Year's Eve is more of a cocktail party, you know, with lots of small hors d'oeuvres around, you know, a couple, you know, maybe you do something like a charcuterie board. You know, you have that out there with some great bread and some olive oil, you know, prosciutto, sopressata, you know, things like that, and cheeses. But for heaven's sake, if you're going to put cheeses out, go to a cheese shop. You know, I was just in Love Lane cheese shop the other day. It's the difference between that and, you know, Wahlbaum's is night and day. I mean, people go and they get these bad cheddar cheese or Swiss cheese in it, but it's awful, you know. And I've seen in caterers do it, you know. They get a block of Swiss cheese the size of a cement brick, you know, and they hack it up and put it out. It's awful. I mean, I had gone to Love Lane Cheese Shop and I got the truffle brie. Remember he brought that truffle brie in here?
Like, yeah.
It's phenomenal, you know. He had an English cheddar that was sharp as a tack, was very good. He had this other one, I couldn't remember it, but it was real nutty-like, and, you know, he's probably got 50, 60, 70 cheeses there to choose from. So if you're going to do a cheese plate, do that. You know, go to a cheesemonger if you're not familiar with what you want. They'll always let you taste, you know, and always give you a little sliver. And experiment around. Taste four or five of them and get something that's really good. And so you put that out. And then if you wanted to do something like a shrimp bowl, you know, for the masses, that's always cool. Make sure you have some cocktail sauce just in case you need some flavor. And then I would do some, you know, past hot hors d'oeuvres, you know, the sky's the limit. You could do a little raw bar if you want, which is always kind of fun. But I would do that. I wouldn't do a dinner. I don't think it's, you know, the sit-down dinner thing.
Can you handle a baked brie?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they're fun. I mean, all that stuff is in play. I mean, there's hundreds of recipes on the internet for hors d'oeuvres, you know, that you can get. But and the wine thing too. I would have some sparkling wine. I mean, it's a fun thing to toast. I think it's one of the most underused wines out there. I mean, most people save sparkling wines for celebrations. You know, You go to a wedding and they give you a bad, you know, sparkling wine or a Prosecco or something. Everybody toasts the bride. Nobody drinks it because it's usually terrible, you know. But, you know, there's some good ones out there. There's a French one. I'm almost sorry I'm bringing this up. A friend of mine brought this wine to a dinner party we were having upstate New York. And it was maybe one of the best champagnes I ever had in my life. And it wasn't that expensive. It was like $70 for the bottle, which is kind of moderately priced champagne. Champagne's pretty expensive. But it was so good. I bought a case. You know, I wound up putting a case in my cellar. But, you know, you can go on the other side of the expensive, you know, French champagnes like Veuve Clicquot or Grand Dame or, you know, Krug, Dom Perignon. We all know those names. You don't really have to do that. They make one of the best sparkling wines I've ever had was from in New Mexico, believe it or not. It's called Gruet, G-R-U-E-T, Gruet Brut. And one of the French champagne makers was scouting for property in California. And he couldn't find exactly what he wanted. And somehow he stumbled onto this property in New Mexico and said, this is exactly what I've been looking for. And he wound up making this sparkling wine in New Mexico. And it's phenomenal. And I don't think it's $25 a bottle. I think you get it for under $25. I'd have to check that. It's been a while since I bought it. But I remember my wholesale price was like $10, $11, which translates probably into $20, $25 at a retail store, you know. So it was really good and really inexpensive. They're out there. You go to East End. I mean, Pominac has a great sparkling wine. It's probably $40, $50. Sparkling Point has five or six of them that are stellar. They have they got a new one they made, I think, last year called Cynthia's Cuvée.
We had that. It was excellent.
It's fabulous. It's made from Pinot Noir. It's killer. And their Seduction, their Brut Seduction, which is their high-end, top-of-the-line champagne, I think it's only $70, which isn't, you know, and you know what? I know everybody's going to say, oh, it's Long Island, da-da-da-da. You know what? You blind taste this against all those champagnes out there, and it does fine. You know, it's, we have one of the members at the club, this guy Rich, and his wife Renee, they're very nice people, very nice. And they're big wine drinkers, and they come in, and they're always asking me to pull up something from the cellar, you know. They kind of trust my palate, so... He was basically a California cab guy for the time I knew him. And then so we've gotten him out of his lane a little bit, you know, drinking some other stuff. And the other night I was doing a little wine and cheese table at the club, right? I was pouring three whites and three reds that were all kind of off the reservation wines that you normally wouldn't have. I had a Cariola white. I had, I'm trying to think what else. Doesn't matter. But anyway, I gave him a taste of... Pominac Cabernet, doesn't manipulate it at all. It'll come to me. But anyway, I gave him a taste of that, and he goes, oh, it's really good. What is it? And I said, it's a Long Island cab. He goes, I hate when you do that to me, you know. I know he wants to hate the wine, but he can't, you know, because it's that good. But it's the same thing with the sparkling wines out there. I mean, Pominac makes a great one. Sparkling Point, five great ones. It's just there's no reason to ignore them, you know. But I think a couple of those, you know, I would do one that's, you know, Blanc de Blanc, which is Blanc de Blanc means white from white, which means it's a white wine made from white grape. And Blanc de Noir is a white wine made from a dark grape like Pinot Noir or Pinot Meunier. And how they do that is there's no skin contact. So if you don't have skin contact, you don't get the color in it. Because all the juice is clear, whether it's red or white grape. But yeah, I would do a couple of those. I'd do a Blanc de Blanc, and I would do a Blanc de Noir. And if you want, you know, to have some fun inexpensively, a Prosecco is good. There are better ones out there, you know. You can go down to, Stu Leonard, and they have a great selection. Total Wine over in Westbury has an even better selection. You know, a lot of good wines there. And you know, talk to the salesman, you know. Don't just take... You know, the $6 Prosecco because it's inexpensive, because you'll regret it. But the bottom line is I would do that. And then, you know, an open bar, you know, you're going to have mixers there, I guess, of people that, you know, drink, you know, scotch or you know, beer or whatever. Obviously, you have to have that stuff. And then I would do one signature drink and do it for the whole party. You know, make up something, you know, go find an interesting recipe. I mean, there are thousands of them on the internet. And then do that one drink, and, you know, and I think you're good. And then I would also, you know, have some coffee and, you know, at the end of the night, if you're going to stay around for the midnight celebration and count the ball down or whatever, I would, you know, obviously have some coffee and then some interesting little finger desserts, you know, little minis. You know, you do mini shooters or mini pastries mm-hmm. or, you know, or arugula, stuff like that, that you just grab one or two for your hands. And I think that's really all you need, you know, as long as you have people get food in their stomach. But, you know, to sit down for dinner, I mean, I'm doing a dinner at the club on New Year's Eve. And to me, it's fine. I mean, I don't mind doing it. But it would, I think a cocktail party would be more fun, you know, because it's a little more convivial, you know. I mean, when you're sitting at dinner, everybody gets, like, loaded down with food and you kind of get tired and, you know, you're talking about politics and arguing and whatever you're doing, you know. A cocktail party, you're moving around a little bit, you know. There's a TV on, maybe a football game, some guys are watching. It's a little more fun for me, I think, you know, a little less formal.
So this year, New Year's Eve and Christmas, I guess, were on
Thursday.
Mm-hmm. So it's always interesting that the day after a holiday is usually a necessary day off.
Yeah, totally.
And it's funny because this year it's tough because, you know, Thanksgiving's always on Thursday and most people get the holiday.
Yeah, they cop
Friday
the weekend.
Off.
Sure, yeah.
You know, Christmas people aren't being so generous.
No, they're not closing Friday.
No, and then they remind you that they're not closing the day after New Year's.
Yeah, well, New Year's Day to me was always I was trying to find something to do. I wound up closing some of the restaurants, and so I had off a couple of New Year's days, and the most fun, I think, I started a tradition where I would go up to the casino up in Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
You take the ferry over. It's 15 minutes from the ferry, right? And I said, everything's closed. There's nothing to do. I'm bored to tears. You know, let's take a ride. So we went up to the casino, and, you know, they always have three or four restaurants. I don't gamble. I mean, I think it's boring. But you know, the shows, to see if you want to see a show, you can see a show, you know. But I used to go to the restaurants because all the restaurants that I wanted to go to were closed on New Year's Day. So I go up there. You know, they had Michael Jordan Steakhouse. They had one of the Tunney guys had an Italian restaurant up there. I think Bobby Flay might have had something. And I would, any other guy, Todd English had one. And I would bounce around. I'd go to, you know, three or four of those places and have appetizers and a glass of wine and then crash up there overnight and come back in the morning. It was fun. It was like the best thing I've thought of to pass, you know, New Year's Day, which to me was always boring, you know, other than a football game. So that's my New Year's Eve, New Year's Day combo. I think.
Well, the difference between the Christmas thing and the New Year's thing is New Year's Eve is the real celebration thing.
Yeah.
So you have New Year's Day to recuperate.
Recovery, yeah.
Christmas Eve is usually a gathering night. Christmas Day is a gathering day.
Yeah, for sure.
So Christmas, the day after Christmas, it's a useful day. I'm sure a lot of people are going to take off because a lot of businesses will close early Christmas Eve or have closed. So we had, say, Wednesday, half a day, Thursday off. They took Friday off, Saturday, and Sunday morning, here they are listening to Playing with Fire with us.
Yeah, well, that's nice. And we're always grateful for that for sure, you know. I've been getting a lot of, lately, I don't know what it is, last week or so, people saying they listen to the show, and it's always nice to hear. You know, complimentary, nobody's yelled at me, so it's nice to hear when, you know, you put this product out there, and there's no way of gauging it other than, I guess, what the Nielsen ratings or whatever they call them. But I'm not privy to those, so I don't know who's listening and who's not. And sometimes the most disparate people, too, you know. I've had some young people come to me and say, oh, wow, heard you on the radio, you know. Yeah, it was really a really fun week in that regard. So anyway, I went to Morrow's the other night in Carl Place. I'm increasingly impressed with this place. I got to tell you, it's a little hole-in-the-wall restaurant. It's very local. It's Carl Place. You know, it's a little dear to my heart because I grew up there. And I used to hang out across the street in Sam and Joe's when I was a kid, a luncheonette fountain there. Next door to it, where the bakery is, used to be a bar called O'Hara's. It was the town bar where everybody... Oh. turned 18, we'd flock there, you know. Anyway, Joey Morrow, who owns Cardinale Bakery, is the proprietor. And his brother, Augie, I think Augie's a partner. I'm not really sure. But Augie, he's the impresario there. He's behind the bar and kind of the maitre d'. He's a big guy with a big personality, a lot of fun. And so I went there the other night with about 8 people. And I had a real good meal, man. I had octopus appetizer that was melting your mouth tender. And it was served on a bed of vegetables. It was really good, you know, good flavor, vinaigrette, whatever. I saw some of the other dishes that were out there. They had that one bread bowl with pasta in it, which to me is just, it's carbohydrates on carbohydrates, you know, surrounded by carbohydrates and drowned in carbohydrates. And, you know, the person who ordered it, she ate maybe, you know, I don't know, 1/10 of it, you know, was full, took the rest home and had to help carrying it out to the car. It was like 2 people had to carry this thing. Anyway, we had, I'm a kind of linguine with clam sauce fan. And it's hard to find a good one. I've had a few. You know, Vincent's Clam Bar has a good one. This was really good. It was a little too much liquid for me. And I guess some people like to dip bread in there or whatever. It's like a second meal. But it was, the flavor was right on point. It was really, really good. I tasted a couple of other people's stuff. It was somebody had lamb. I'm trying to think of what else. There was another pasta dish, spaghetti and meatballs. All of it really, really well done. The bread was good. It's just, obviously, the bread's good. It's Cardinale, you know. But I got to hand it to Joey. It was Saturday night. It was a packed house. I hope they're doing well. And I told Augie he should come on to the radio show and, you know, and talk about it. And you'll see him. Well, in order to get through that door, Augie's going to have to duck and twist. He's the largest human being I've ever seen in my life. He's about 4 foot thick and about 5 foot wide. And thank God he's a gentle giant, because he'd be a handful if he wasn't. Good guy. But it's a great little restaurant. You got to check it out. I got to go down there. I'm telling everybody I know. You know, it's on Westbury Avenue in Carr Place. It used to be La Bottega years ago, if people know that location. So it's right there next to the Cardinale Bakery Warehouse. And you'll love it. I'm telling you. And it's you know, it's fairly priced. It's not expensive. It's just killer. Killer little joint.
So let's take a break, and then we'll come back. I have a pizza question for you.
Come on now, everybody, get ready for a treat. It's time for stepping out for something mighty good to eat. You looking for atmosphere? Well, they got it happening here. They're doing barbecue the way it ought to be. Bring your sister, brother, sniffing an other. Bring all your pals. There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
It's the holiday season, and Al's got the smoking party for you. Bring the whole gang for Al's new grand feast, which includes the new smoking poo-poo platter, haystack onions, barbecue nachos, chicken wings, and a whole lot of barbecue meats, baby back ribs, lots of sides, and cornbread. The feast keeps on coming. A whole lot of fun for any type of group get-together. Available in dining room or takeout. Smoking Al's, Massapequa Park. For details, call 516-799-4900. And remember, there's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show, with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Now, before your pizza question, I just got to tell you, you know, Snapple's my drug of choice in the morning.
Sure.
So here I am. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but all the Snapple caps have a little anecdotal thing on it.
Do they still have numbers also?
I don't know. I can't see that well. But it says the dots on a domino are called pips.
Pips? Who not knew that Gladys Knight and the pips was Gladys Knight and the dominoes?
I know. And who would think that you could quench your thirst and become a Jeopardy champion all at the same time? Probably now I'm the oracle of useless information anyway, but this is another one I'm going to add to my roster of things that nobody cares about.
There you go. Now, I know we've talked about pizza many times, but I was either watching something or I guess I was watching something, but they were talking about preparation of pizza. So obviously you have the crust, the right dough that you roll out or whatever. And then traditional pizza is tomato sauce and then the cheese put on top. And I guess there's a whole thing about putting the cheese on and then the sauce. And what does that do? And what's your take on all that?
I think it's just people trying to reinvent the wheel and be different or whatever. I think Chicago Pizza, they do that a lot, if I'm not mistaken. They put the cheese on first.
This was a place in Lindenhurst.
Oh, yeah? I don't know. Pizza's a really interesting thing. I've been, my friend Mike Dorio and I and his wife and Val and I, we've been doing these pizza runs, you know, rating these, you know, these restaurants as, they rate them. I don't get involved too much in the rating, but they it's fun for them too. They do the restaurant critic thing with the pizza. And, you know, pizza to me is all about the dough. And there's different styles. And so I was trying to explain to Mike, you know, there's a New York style pizza, which is crisper, you know, and when you hold it up, it doesn't flop. And then there's a Naples style pizza, which is, the dough's made a little differently. It's there's much more water in the dough, and it doesn't have that crispy thing. It flops a little bit, but, you know, it blackens on the outside, which I like. It's made with a different flour. So anyway, but the bottom line is, there are different doughs, like I said, and the difference in the doughs generally is the hydration and how much water you have in it. The other thing is how long you're going to ferment the dough and how slowly. Most of those doughs start with a starter, which is, flour, water, and yeast that's allowed to bloom. And you sit that on the side and you take a little bit of that and you put it into your dough mixture when you mix the flour, the water, the yeast, the sugar, whatever you're using, and use a little bit of starter, then you refresh the starter. So there's starters that are actually alive because the yeast is alive. And I know people who have had starters for 25 years. You know, they're 25 years old, the same starter. They just keep feeding it and take a little out and using it when they need it and feed it again. And so that's really the whole crux of pizza making is the dough. Some people ferment the dough for 3 days, some for overnight, you know, depending on how much flavor you want to get in your dough. There are sourdough pizzas now, which are kind of fun, you know, which, add a little more flavor to the dough. The topping thing to me is all kind of sort of not incidental, but it's really the secondary part. And it's just a question of your ingredients. Your New York pizza has, you know, usually part skim mozzarella on it. You know, they take the shredded mozzarella, it's part skim, and there's not a lot of water in it, so it melts, and you get that, you know, that cheese pizza that we all know and love by the slice. You know, if you want to get a little more technical, you go to margarita route, you're going to have, you know, whole milk mozzarella, you know, with a little bit of maybe Parmesan or Pecorino cheese on there and some fresh basil. After that, you know, the sky's the limit. I mean, people have gone from, you know, mushrooms and onions and pepperoni and you know, things that we all remember as a child, you know, when you to now it's like the modern age of pizza making. I mean, I make some with goat cheese, rosemary, and roasted garlic. Some people are doing pineapples and ham or whatever. But there's, you know, you're only limited by your imagination and how much tolerance you have to, you know, get out of the lane of, you know, what an Italian pizza would be. You know, what's his name? Frank Pepe, he's, you know, famous for the clam pizza up in New Haven, which I think is a good idea. other stuff that we've done pizza with duck confit and you know, with eggs on it, you know, like that millionaire pizza I used to do with the truffles, mushrooms, and the egg. So I think it's just a question of, you know, what you like and how, you know, or if from a chef standpoint, what, you know, the market will bear, what people are interested in. I think what you're referring to is that Chicago style of pizza where they make it, they cook the dough first a little bit. It's thicker, right? It's like a deep dish thing.
Well, Chicago pizza, I'm familiar. It sort of has a, it's like deep dish pizza.
Yeah, deep dish.
But
there used to be a place in Commack that had it.
There's a couple. There's one in Belmore. I forget the name of it. I saw a reel on Instagram about upside down pizza, and it was Villa Pizza in Lindenhurst.
Oh, yeah.
So that was interesting. But then there's also something new. I'll call it skillet pizza, but crustless pizza, which people are doing. Essentially, it's cheese and sauce and topping, I guess.
I guess so. I've seen cauliflower crust. You know, everybody's afraid of gluten now, whatever. I don't know. It's all fine. I mean, if you want to have a cauliflower crusted pizza, go get them. It's not for me. I'm more of a traditionalist. I like the pizza for what it is. And it's funny because, you know, Mike swears by this place in Westchester called Johnny's, and it's in Mount Vernon. And if you've never been to Johnny's Pizza in Mount Vernon, you owe yourself a trip. It's worth the drive. It's maybe the best pizza I have, best New York pizza I've ever had in my life, to the point where I ate a whole pie. And I haven't eaten a whole pie in a week, in any other place. I mean, at a sitting, a whole pie. And I didn't feel like I swallowed a small farm animal either on the way home. It was like you were still awake, and it was probably the flour that they're using or whatever. But it was fabulous. Again, crisp, a great crunch to it, a lot of flavor. The tomato is good. And the other thing, too, is I think a lot of people tend to screw with the tomato sauce a little bit too much. I get sugar in it. You go to some pizza places and, that sauce can be sweet or darker red than it should be. It's just tomatoes and olive oil. A little bit of salt is what you need there, you don't need a lot of other stuff in there, garlic powder and things that people put in.
There's a really good deep dish pizza place in Belmore. I was mentioning Belmore, Wantagh, Stella's.
Oh yeah,
really nice, right on Merrick Road.
Yeah,
sort of across from Blackbird.
Yeah. I go past there somewhat frequently. My dentist is over there, so a couple of times a year I'm dragging
myself. How do you end up with a dentist in Belmore?
Well, my partner used to be a dentist in Belmore.
Oh, okay.
And he sold it to, he retired, so he sold it to a new dentist in Belmore. And it's easy, I'm familiar with the building and the people or whatever, So it became that. Anyway, there was a place in Commack. It's not there anymore. That used to have deep dish pizza. It was on Jericho Turnpike before you got to Commack Road. And it had almost a little lighthouse. You remember that?
No.
It was a building with a little lighthouse on top. I can't think of the name of it. Anyway, I don't know. I'm not a fan. I think if you grow up with New York pizza, you kind of get spoiled. And it's probably the same for Chicagoans, And there's another style now called Detroit pizza. Have you seen that? It's kind of like Sicilian a little bit. I never eat that stuff. I'll have a grandma once in a while because I like the olive oil and the dough. Mm-hmm. I like the way it tastes. Well, I don't know. I always go back to, my friend Jay, who owns the Onion Tree over in Seacliff. He does great pizza. I mean, he's won a couple of contests and stuff. But his style is all Neapolitan style, And that's completely different. You're not going to get. I try and explain this to Mike. It's like, you're rating apples and hand grenades here. It's not like the New York style pizza isn't like the other one. It's not supposed to be. So when you rate New York style pizza, you should rate it against other New York style pizzas, and same with the other.
So I got to ask you this: we've talked about it before. Penne alla vodka.
Oh no!
You say has no vodka in it.
Generally, it doesn't.
Yeah. So I saw another reel on Instagram where they were preparing penne alla vodka, and they did include vodka.
Right.
And I did some research. So here's what I'm being told now. The key functions of vodka in the sauce: flavor extraction. Alcohol dissolves and carries flavor compounds from the tomatoes that water alone can't, adding depth. Whatever. Aroma enhancement. As the volatile alcohol evaporates, it carries these flavors and aromas up, making the sauce smell and taste more vibrant. We got more. Emulsification.
Wait.
It helps bind the cream and water and tomato together, creating the signature glossy, smooth, creamy texture. And the last, balancing richness. It adds a slight lightness of acidity, balancing the richness with the cream and fat. Notes the New York Times.
I think it's all, First of all, let's debunk the aroma thing, all right? The alcohol evaporates, supposedly carrying the aroma with it, right? By the time it gets to the dining room, there's no aroma left. It's all evaporated
right.
already. You know what I mean? I think that's somebody just, searching for a reason. The bottom line is there's no flavor in vodka, It's flavorless, pretty much, right? So you're adding something that's flavorless to something that has flavor. right? So what is it adding? It's not adding anything.
It's dulling the flavor.
If you're doing it in the dining room and you want to make a sauce and you want to do a show and you put it on fire or whatever, okay, I get it then.
Well, that's funny you say that because that was the thing they said. You got to be very careful because otherwise your vodka will ignite.
Yeah, well, it does ignite, you know. But the bottom line is it's just useless. I mean, by the time you boil the alcohol out of it, which is the only redeeming aspect of vodka, my humble opinion, you know, it's over, you know, and it's not, you might as well add water. And I don't think vodka, you know, if you look at vodka, I mean, what about vodka is different than water as far as, you know, melding everything together? It's not melding anything. It's just adding volume. That's all. Flavorless volume. I make vodka sauce because people expect it sometimes, or request it, I should say, especially on buffets. But I scratch my head. Yeah, okay. It's like there are some things that are completely useless that we're hanging on to as a culture in food. Crudité platter. Remember years ago, I mean, you were a South Shore Inn guy, right? They'd come with a little glass bowl. You know, it had olives, a radish, a piece of celery, and a couple of carrots in it, and they would put it on every table in the 60s.
But that's what comes with when I go to the
your
soup place.
Seafood platter.
When I go to the soup place, they bring me a platter of vegetables that I put into the thing.
Anyway, it's just every once in a while I'll do a party, and we're trying to do a menu, and the ladies say, oh, we need a crudité platter. And my response is always the same. Don't waste your money. Nobody's going to eat it. You get one vegetarian out there who's going to have a carrot or two.
So if you could rename penne alla vodka, again, it's a creamy tomato sauce. In chef language, what's creamy tomato sauce? How do you express that?
Vecchia vitola.
Oh.
If you go to Nick and Tony's in East Hampton, they make a textbook, fabulous example of vodka sauce. I don't think they use the vodka, but that's what it's called in Italy, Vecchia Vitola. B-E-C-C-H-I-A, I think it is, V-E-T-T-O-L-A. Anyway, if you look that up, you'll find it's vodka sauce.
And then is bolognese always with a cream in it, or some people don't?
No, there's a lot of variations on bolognese. Bolognese technically is milk. They use milk in it, not cream, in Italy. But there's white bolognese, there's bolognese without tomato, there's a lot of different
variations.
And do a
lot of people dice carrots into their sauce?
Yeah, that's part of, the mirepoix that goes in there, the onions, carrots, and celery. It's all part of the flavoring aspect of it, you know. And bolognese is, you know, classic dishes are classic for a reason. I mean, they've stood the test of time. And, you know, bolognese obviously comes from Bologna, Italy, where they have a lot of beef.
And is bolognese usually a beef or a veal or a pork?
Well, a lot of people use a combination of all three, you know, like they do with meatballs. I don't use pork in any of that, you know, only because I don't think it adds anything. So I use beef and veal for my meatballs when I make them, and I use beef generally by itself for the bolognese. You know, when you get those bolognese's that are made with chopped meat, you know, which isn't wrong, but they'll use ground beef for that, you know, or ground beef and veal. I tend to use, I'll call them scraps. They're not really scraps. Like if I make a filet mignon, if I have filet mignon, that tail piece is useless to me as far as the filet goes. So I'll save those. We'll dice them up and I'll make bolognese out of it. That's what, getting back to what I was calling utilization of things that, you know, normally would go by the wayside, the garbage or the help. So you can turn those things into, you know, bolognese. So I like, when I have bolognese, I like pieces of beef in there, not just the ground stuff, you know. I think it makes for a better product, obviously. And it also allows me to, use pieces of scrap meat that I normally wouldn't have. When I break down a New York strip, there's a good end and a quote-unquote bad end. The bad end has, you know, grizzle running through it, so you can't really serve them. Traditionally, chefs would go, oh, well, we saved those for well done. Well, what do you, don't like the well done people? I mean, you're going to give them an inferior thing and punish them for order? It's ridiculous, right? So I take that meat, I clean it up, I take the grizzle out, and I'll use that.
And what actually is grizzle?
Grizzle is like a tendon thing that runs through, or some kind of a fat thing. And I'll use that for, you know, I'll make chili with that, or I'll make bolognese with that, or I'll make some kind of stew, you know, a beef bourguignon or whatever, I'll cut into chunks. there's ways to utilize that stuff without it going in the garbage, you know. And that's what, you know, that's what makes food costs manageable. You know, I was talking about this with somebody the other day as far as the restaurant industry goes. You know, the costs are out of control. Yeah, they are. Yeah, food's high. Yeah, food's high. But you can mitigate that, you know. I can't mitigate payroll, you know, because I need X amount of people to do X amount of things, and I'm not allowed to pay them X amount of money. I have to pay them what the government says I have to pay them, you know. So it is what it is, and you know, you just, that's the biggest problem now with, I don't know about any other business, but my business in particular, it's payroll. Anyway, on that note, Stu, we got to get out of here. We're running over time here.
Well, Tom, let's take a minute to say thank you.
Yes.
Happy New Year. A healthy, prosperous New Year to you and your family.
Yeah, we appreciate all you listeners, and thanks for tuning in every week and making this show what it is. So we're going to say Happy New Year to all, and Tom's Three Keys to Life as we close the show. Our life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last, and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And we'll see you in 2026.
God bless you. Happy New Year.
Come on now, everybody. Get ready for a treat. It's time for stepping out for something mighty good to eat. You looking for atmosphere? Well, they got it happening here. They're doing barbecue the way it ought to be. Bring your sister, brother, sniffing an other. Bring all your pals. There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
It's the holiday season, and Al's got the smoking party for you. Bring the whole gang for Al's new grand feast, which includes the new smoking poo-poo platter, haystack onions, barbecue nachos, chicken wings, and a whole lot of barbecue meats, baby back ribs, lots of sides, and cornbread. The feast keeps on coming. A whole lot of fun for any type of group get-together. Available in dining room or takeout. Smoking Al's, Massapequa Park. For details, call 516-799-4900. And remember, there's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.